Hello and welcome to Wine With Us. This is Nikos, your host. Today I'm joined with Dylan.
Dylan Shimon, CEO at SidePen and organizer of Half Stack conferences and co-founder of Dojo.
Yes, and also with Juho.
Yeah, my name is Juho Vepsilainen. I mean, you have to say it one time. But, anyway, I run Rec Finland, and we did Craftful Finland, maybe do it again next year. And I've written some books under brand Survive.js. So it's one book about React and Webpack and maintenance and this kind of stuff.
It really is a great name for a series. Like, surviving JS is kind of how we feel at all times, right?
Yeah, that was the starting point, because I felt it's too much, because it was so chaotic, especially like 5 years ago. We had so many technologies. We have even more now, but it looks like there's some convergence, or let's say now people, they know a little bit better how to do web applications and everything.
I thought everything was going to revolve around web, but then I started doing Svelte, and then he starts using Rollup for the blueprints of the Svelte applications, but you can also use Webpack for that as well.
Well, he does create Rollup.
Yeah, he does.
It is a bit of an opinion, which is great. I mean, it's nice. As soon as it feels like we only have one choice, that's when things go wrong, I think.
You go into Rich Harris's Twitter, and he says he's a graphic designer, but yet he's coming out with all this like amazing stuff, you know, like...
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the creator of D3, he wasn't really an engineer either, but he knew how to visualize data and needed a platform to do it. Mm-hmm. I myself am not a programmer by training. I went to school for physical chemistry and mathematics.
Yeah.
And I just happened to do that right at the time the web was in its infancy. And I said, well, this is really cool, and just started writing like websites on the side for fun. And then it sort of evolved such that I liked that more than the smell of chloroform every day, and switched careers halfway through my PhD program. I dropped out and started the company I do today.
And how long before you could live off of that?
It was a couple of years before. I mean, I was living very leanly the first couple of years, and we were trying to build, the company was called SitePen, so we were trying to make it as easy as using a pen to build websites. Plus, it was kind of the early 2000s era where you just stick two random words together and create a company name. And then what we realized is that was a really difficult problem to solve at the time. This was like 10 years before Google Page Creator or Wix had really found their way. But I learned a ton about JavaScript. And then I realized at the time, people needed help with JavaScript because they wanted to do stuff in the browser, but Ajax hadn't been coined, Google Maps and Gmail weren't a thing yet, but there were still companies saying, what can we do in the browser? And I realized I could be a really good consultant because I've already sort of figured all of this stuff out, and just kind of grew from there.
Yeah, things like Wix and WordPress, they cater to sort of the small webs, businesses. Medium businesses, I don't know any that use Wix or WordPress.
Which is fair. Yeah, absolutely. But it's sort of the idea of democratizing, you know, information and applications, and making it possible for anyone with an idea to be able to at least get started is really powerful, and I think impressive. Even if they don't understand the technology, at least they can, you know, have some possibility of getting started building something. And then if it's successful, then they can, you know, find engineers and help them build it for real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the greatest business or greatest business person is someone who doesn't know how much work is ahead. Because if you knew how much work you have to do to get somewhere, you will not start. So you have to be very idealistic in the beginning, otherwise you will never do it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, especially conferences.
Oh yeah, everyone thinks it's super easy to create a conference and everyone will just show up and you'll make a lot of money. And it doesn't really work that way, which is fair, because it feels like there are a million conferences, but there's a huge variation in the quality of the conference, what you get as an attendee, what the speakers are like. And so I've been working on this concept of trying to disrupt conferences by making them very authentic. And what I mean by that, so we have this conference called Half Stack, and we ran it the past 4 years in London. And this year we've expanded to New York and Vienna and also in London. And next year we're going to be in four more cities. We're going to Phoenix, which is where I live, Charlotte, North Carolina, Tel Aviv, and Newquay, which is in the southwest of the UK. And it might sound like random places, but it's kind of picking places that either have a really established tech scene or cities that have a growing tech scene but don't have great conferences. Mm-hmm. And what sort of makes this event different is it's really a celebration of what we can create and why, and less about the how. And so it's a very UI-centric JavaScript and web conference. It's a place for speakers to try new things or experiment or not take themselves too seriously. And the idea is you attend this event and you just get exposed to random things you would have never considered that are fun and engaging. And it kind of reminds you why you became an engineer, which is to be creative or to create something, rather than it being like, here's how you use Webpack or here's how you use React or whatever. Those are important lessons. But this conference is like, okay, yeah, I happen to use React, but I created this really amazing demo with music and maps and something crazy. Or I like one of the speakers, Ramon, who's local, he's speaking tomorrow. Tomorrow, this is the Halfstack Vienna conference. And his talk is about his personal project called DanceMat.js. And basically what he did is him and his partner, they really love playing Dance Dance Revolution, the game. And they kept wearing out the commercial mats that you could buy.
Oh, really?
So they got a yoga mat and figured out how to hook it up to like some like tape that registers where they're dancing. And they created this project so they could play DDR as much as they want. And the only thing they have to do is buy a new yoga mat or fix some electrical tape in the right direction. And it's a really inspiring story. So he's promised to bring the mat and his wife and demo it. So I'm hoping that will happen.
Yeah, right. You're saying about coming across things you'd never been exposed to. And that's sometimes the biggest changes can happen. Because like I had a coffee or lunch with Yoho about 2 months ago. And we were talking about React most of the lunchtime, and at the end of it, he goes, "Yeah, maybe Svelte might be actually a thing." And I didn't know what Svelte was. Now I'm basically doing all my time now I'm focusing on Svelte, and it's yes. Just off of his comment.
You should have told him about Dojo.
I met Rich in summer. I went to CSS camp and JS camp in Barcelona, and I met Rich. He's really kind of down to earth, really good developer. I think he's more pragmatic than like theoretical kind of guy, but I think that's why he gets things done, because he starts from his actual problems.
I'm interested in, lately I've been talking about sort of a post-React world, and what I mean by that is I feel like we've reached peak interest in React, not because it's bad, but it's sort of things reach their maximum and then people start to look for different things because they get frustrated with how things are or the status quo, or they want to try new things. And there's sort of a class of new frameworks that could potentially take away some of the interest in React. And in my mind, those are Svelte, Stencil, and Dojo, which are three very different approaches. And so Svelte is very much they call it the disappearing framework. It's really more of a compiler than it is a framework. It has frameworky bits. You write the code, and then it strips most of that JavaScript out at runtime, which is cool. Mm-hmm. But the potential negative is when you get to a very large application, you may find yourself actually ending up with quite a bit of code. But on the surface, it's small. And actually, all three of the frameworks I just mentioned are very small for their sort of reference applications. Like if you look at the real world application as kind of a good reference application, the default build for those three is like 1/10 the size of what you get with React or Angular or even Vue, for example. Mm-hmm. Stencil is very much focused on how do I build web components, but I could use JSX to do that. They've tried to make it so you could write a component library using the tools you know, and you end up with components that work in any of the modern frameworks. And then Dojo has really tried to say, how would we write a complete framework today that's super small? So it's a TypeScript first framework that supports things like JSX, it supports web components, and it has kind of all the pieces you would logically need to build like a reactive application. So it has a routing or routing library, it has a component system, it has a number of optimizations and patterns, it has its own approach to data stores, basically a very different approach to Redux that to us kind of cleanly fixes all the things people complain about with Redux. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like a lot, but then you look at what you get and you know your Hello World application is like 10 kilobytes gzip, so it's pretty tiny. And so we've really tried, and I say we because I work on Dojo, and there was old Dojo for like 15 years and the new Dojo came out last year. And we've done things like built in the equivalent of Gatsby into the framework, but on a component level. So you can basically do what we call build time rendering to, or pre-rendering, to effectively on a component, say, well, at build time, pull in this node module and convert this markdown file to HTML. And then at runtime, that all can be erased. You can basically do a static site if you want. So the new Dojo website itself is super fast because it ships, the only JavaScript it ships by default is the Google Analytics code. And if you want to load an example, then it'll pull that code in later. But so it's a completely static HTML and CSS site that loads super fast, but it was all authored in Dojo. And to a React developer, if you squint, it looks like React code, but it is this other framework that works similarly. But we feel like we've kind of fixed all the things that have frustrated us over the past few years working with React. So there's a lot of really interesting things going on. That one of the challenges I see with frameworks is if you get big, you get stuck. Because like React did the whole thing around hooks to try to solve a lot of problems they've had. But in many ways, it just introduces new problems. And there are things they simply can't deprecate without alienating 20 or 30% of their users. And we went through this life cycle with Dojo. We've seen it with jQuery. We saw it with MooTools and Prototype and Angular 1 and so on. You eventually get so big that you spend all of your time stuck supporting users, but you can't fix fundamental things without causing a massive rewrite for everyone. And so we kind of waited until no one cared anymore to do a from the ground up rewrite of our thing and completely change. It shares the name Dojo, but it's completely different in what it is today.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
So at the same time, I mean, during the past year and a half, what I've been doing, I use React, but that's not so important. But what I've been doing is I've been developing design systems. So I have this friend that's really design oriented. And we work as a pair. So he works more on design and I work more on architecture and coding stuff, and we just pair and get a lot of things done together. And during this period of time I've been working with my friend, I've been like learning to appreciate web development from different perspective. So it's less about developing the app, it's more about developing the language. I mean the language between designers and developers. So mm-hmm. When we start a project, first, we spend like 2 or 3 weeks frustrating the client because they don't see anything. It's just to develop the design system, the, like the building blocks, before you can do anything productive. So we make this library of like primitives and patterns, and out of these we compose views. And for me, this was really a big revelation, because if you learn to do something like this in a very effective manner, it's a skill you can take anywhere. So it doesn't matter if you use React, Angular, or Dojo, whatever. If you have these design skills, if you can design, the tool doesn't matter so much.
And design systems are another great example of democratizing development, because oftentimes designers know what they want to do, but in the past, if they tried to generate code with like Dreamweaver or FrontPage or Flash or whatever, They would end up with terrible, unusable code. But instead, if you give them a design system where they can kind of pick and choose what they need and express it in a fairly simple, consistent way, you end up with something that then you as an engineer can work with rather than throw away code or starting from scratch.
Yeah, so I think what's happening right now is that we are bridging the gap between designers and developers. So I think this means developers will learn something about design, designers will learn something about developers, and we will see new tools emerge in this space where, like, let's say we have a tool that will generate a design and code. These kind of tools exist already, and it's just a matter of time that we can improve this collaboration between designers and developers a lot. And maybe one day we don't even have designers and developers anymore. We just have people working together. It's not so important if you're this or that. It's just that you work as a team and get things done.
Yeah, I mean, some of the tools out there have gotten quite good at generating really nice code, which is surprising to me. And one of the nicest things our design team does is they sort of create clickable wireframes that sort of express real behavior. And it's much easier to communicate what you're trying to do when you can create that. And they're easier to collect. A lot of them are web-based, so they're collaborative rather than sort of static snapshots in time. One of my favorite ways of explaining how a truly amazing designer is really good is I like to go back and look at Michelangelo. And Michelangelo, you know, sculpted David, right? But he didn't just sit down and try to create a sculpture. He like studied human physiology and he understood how marble worked and he cut open cadavers to see how muscles moved. And so the point is, he really understood his medium that he was working with before he designed. And I think the best designers at least have some understanding of how engineering works, so they don't design things that are impossible to implement or that are inefficient to implement, because they understand the marble of the web, which is effectively JavaScript, HTML, CSS, to an extent to know this is possible, this is maybe not possible, I don't know, and this is really a bad idea because it's slow and not, you know, poorly performant. And really getting people collaborating is truly important to what we do today.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit more to it, of course. So I mean, what I mean is that if you have some amount of diversity in your team, you will get more viewpoints, and because of this, you get better designs, because now you can see the design from more perspectives.
Absolutely.
So I know there's this company in Finland, and they have a coder that's blind. Mm-hmm. And this has implications on how they work. And I think when you have diverse teams, it's like this. So someone that sees differently or doesn't see it's really going to affect the way you write the website, for instance. So let's say you have the web app and there's a blind person using it. It's going to look completely different than for someone who can see the actual site. So.
Absolutely. I think the added benefit of having that diversity and building things that are accessible is they become easier for everyone. And the classic example in the physical world is curbs with ramps to support wheelchairs, right? Mm-hmm. And those were added over the past 30 years to most cities. And it makes it possible for someone in a wheelchair to get around a city. But it also makes it easier for someone on a bicycle to get around the city. Or it makes it easier for someone pushing a stroller or a push buggy with their baby in it to get across the street by having this ramp. And a lot of like accessibility keyboard shortcuts are something that, you know, were designed to make something usable. But then, of course, anyone who uses the web enough knows there are keyboard shortcuts they can use in a page to, you know, make features work. And there's just a lot of examples of having that diverse background leads to better experiences for everyone. Mm. So it's not like a tax on, you know, on the population. It actually makes your application better for everyone who uses it.
Yeah, I mean, one example is focus handling. So when we build an application, we put some thought into how to handle the focus and how to use this thing with keyboard. And I mean, it's accessible, but then you have these power users that really want to get things done fast. So they just use keyboard, they don't use mouse anymore to do things.
Yeah, one of our clients builds emergency response systems. Like if you call, my house is on fire, or I need to go to the hospital, right? In the US, we call that 911 systems, but that's based on the phone number we dial. And for many years, these systems were green screen terminals. Then the people who work on them, the operators, have such muscle memory with their hands that every keystroke matters, because it's a matter of life or death, literally. Mm. And these technologies are becoming really outdated, and they can't hire anyone new because people in their 20s have never seen an application like this. Mm. So they want to move it to the web. But to move it to the web, they still have to preserve this muscle memory. Otherwise, the power users will fail. Yeah. And it's really challenging to get perfect keyboard handling and focus events to happen exactly like they do, you know, on this sort of native terminal application. We achieved it for one of our clients, but it's still one of those things that's kind of challenging. There are some YCG proposals that'll hopefully make this even easier going forward. But it's definitely like a area of accessibility meets power users meets convenience that makes for a better experience overall.
Yeah, I think one of the things is when you move in the web, when you move to these use cases that are not so common, you start hitting the edges of the standards. So you start seeing that everything is not so perfect, or there's something missing, or something doesn't work.
Yeah, it's like I always say, web standards first need to make something possible, then they need to make it good, then they need to make it perfect. The perfect example early on was SVG. Before SVG or Canvas, you couldn't do native vector graphics or drawing in a browser, at least not without a whole bunch of divs and a bunch of silly hacks, right? Yeah. They weren't great specs, and they're still not great specs, but at least they provide a platform that then we can build abstractions on top of it that make it possible to do real drawing in a browser. Yeah. And so they're definitely rough edges and areas. And I think early on in the days of the web, we made the mistake of saying we want to make things easy to use, right? And easy isn't always the right answer, because you need to make something approachable, but you can't take something that's really powerful and replace it with something that takes 10 times as long to get a common job task done. You know, you've simplified it, but you've added obstacles to productivity.
Yeah, because abstractions are leaky, so you have this high-level abstraction and it doesn't do something, and now you have to go down in the stack and like it gets...
Yeah, like I always say, like if you're trying to create something with lots of data and it's harder to use than Excel, then you've failed.
Mm.
Because the people that use it will just go back to Excel rather than filling in 500 form fields.
Oh.
And you know, you just have that challenge in general to really make sure that things are not ignoring the most common use cases. So it's not always the use case of easy, it's the use case of, you know, powerful yet approachable.
Mm. Yeah.
Fascinating stuff, guys. Fascinating stuff. Whoa, where do I come in here?
Sorry, we talk a lot, don't we?
Yeah, the reason that we're getting together today is that we're all going to this Half Stack conference tomorrow. By the time this podcast is released, it'll be over, because this will be over a week later. So,
but we'll have more events. So we're gonna have 7 events next year.
Oh, really?
So we have Half Stack Vienna tomorrow, September 19th in Vienna, obviously. We'll be in London the 22nd of November. And then next year, we'll be in Phoenix in January. We'll be in Charlotte, North Carolina in April, Tel Aviv in May, Newquay, UK in July, New York in August, Vienna in September, and London again next year in November.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind this conference series and why we're doing so many of them is people have been asking me for years, when will you bring Half Stack to my city? And so I've kind of said yes to an increasing number of people. And the idea is I want to bring this event. It's small and intimate. Like the largest event will be 300 people. That way you can meet everyone. Most of them are more around 150 people or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is we bring in mostly local speakers or regional speakers with a few invited international guests. And that way it's not just bring in the same 10 people from around the world to each event, but it's sort of get a mix of people that have spoken at Half Stack before combined with local speakers that have interesting stuff to share. And then most of the attendees are local. I would say about 80% are typically local, and then about 20% travel from anywhere from a short train ride to halfway around the world. Just sometimes people like to go visit a city and there's a conference there they want to see. But so the point of that is the idea is we're really bringing community together that already is there. And we're doing it in a very inviting, inclusive, fun, affordable, laid-back manner. And we do some really fun things that are different than most conferences. So we start a bit later. Like the conference doesn't really kick off till 10. A lot of conferences start at 8 or 9, which is too early for developers. Yeah. We have a lot of talks in the day, but they're fairly fast-paced. So the longest talk is 30 minutes. Some are as short as 10 minutes. And the idea is get on, tell your story, get off the stage, next speaker comes up. We have lunch and dinner included, and snacks. We have, at most events, we have an open bar starting around lunchtime. That way people can have a drink and feel relaxed rather than feeling like they have to cram their drinking into the after party. We have a dinner plus after party, and the after party typically includes something fun. For most of our events, it's a JavaScript pub quiz, which is sort of modeled after a British trivia quiz in a bar. And these questions could be quite obscure. Like one year we asked, what's the tallest div you can draw in the following browsers? And some of them, it's 12 million pixels. And Chrome, it's like 4 trillion before it runs out of memory trying to calculate it. But the way you would know that is if you've ever tried to build a data grid component or an infinite virtual scrolling list, eventually it just collapses to zero because you've made it too tall. And so like these are just, and then we put people in teams. And so what it does is it makes the after party a bit more, people are talking and they're having fun, they're doing something together, but it's not like an engineering quiz, it's a trivia quiz. So last year I gave a talk called Cats versus Dogs, which is about the silly debates we have in tech about like tabs versus spaces and automatic semicolon insertion. And then in the pub quiz, one of the questions was cats versus dogs. And I had asked like Brendan Eich and a bunch of other, like Douglas Crockford and other famous JavaScript people, mm-hmm. what they preferred. And so the question was basically to try to guess if these people preferred cats or dogs, which was, so it's just kind of a fun twist on trivia. This year's conference, it's going to be about sci-fi a bit. So I'm doing a talk called Yoda Web Spock, which is a look at how sci-fi predicts the future of the web platform. It's very silly and ridiculous, but it's fun. And but so the pub quiz is going to have questions about whether people prefer Spock or Yoda or neither. And then there'll be some questions like we'll ask some abbreviations, which are common, like PWA, what's PWA stand for? But then we'll ask what TARDIS stands for, which is from Doctor Who. And so just kind of like just a funny twist on trivia. And so we just look for these little things that make the conference special. In Phoenix, we're having it at an Alamo Drafthouse Cinema, which is this movie chain in the US that has really good food and has their own brewed beer. And so pretty cool venue. But then for the after party, as part of it, we're going to show Hackers, which is Angelina Jolie's first movie where she is a hacker. And it's like this late 80s, early 90s tech movie that's really, it's not done well with the test of time, but it's still enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And then in Tel Aviv, we're going to be in a circus theater. So we're looking at having some trapeze artists perform for one of the talks that'll do like data visualization of how they are moving in real time. So just kind of looking for fun things to sort of reflect the local community. And then similarly, our lunch tomorrow is going to include like pretzels and Wiener Schnitzel and stuff like that to give it a bit of a local flair. Mm. And really, we just try to capture the essence of each community as much as we can without, you know, being over the top, and just create a really nice experience for our attendees. And what I emphasize is our attendees are the product. I mean, are not the product. They are the customer. A lot of conferences make the ticket prices really cheap, and then you realize all the talks were paid for, or there's a bunch of booths and they're just trying to sell you stuff all day, or after the fact you get 50 emails trying to sell you stuff. And I know GDPR has cleaned that up a bit, but we don't only work in Europe. And so we have no booths, we have no vendor pitch talks, we have no emails that we're going to spam you with from the sponsors. So it's very much all about the attendee experience. If a sponsor wants to get involved, their benefit is they're helping be part of this great community and showing that they care about the community and, you know, being affiliated with that. And they can offer swag, or they can pick up lunch or dinner or things like that. So we feel like it sort of realigns how conferences should work, rather than being this, it's sort of the opposite of Web Summit. Web Summit does great, but it's got 60,000 people. And it makes hundreds of millions, if not more, euros each year. But it is the least enjoyable conference I've been to in a long time, because all you do is spend time queuing, and you don't interact with the speakers at all. And all you're doing is waiting for everything. And everywhere you turn, you're having to pay for food. You're having to pay for this. You spend 20 minutes waiting for the toilet. And that's not fun to me. That's just like Disneyland without the rides. So, yeah.
Well, but you, how do you manage to get your unique flavor of conferences? What do you...
Yeah, so React Finland is not so extreme. It's somewhere in that like middle of commercial and middle of community conference. It's more on the community conference side. So it's how to do it. I mean, we have sponsored talks. I mean, sponsored like 5 minutes. So like this year, what was really funny for me is that is like, I think it was really big team, like 7 persons that went on the stage to present their company. And then it was like this accidental comedy, like stand-up sketch, because they were not prepared. And like, they just went to the stage and they asked every developer like something, and it was completely absurd. So it
was that's like, at least taking it fun and understanding your audience. So that's cool.
Yeah. So for us, the sponsors, somehow we try to make it so that they bring value to the conference. So we have huge venue. I mean, it's like 5 floors, big building with 3,000 people or something, and we get 400 people for the conference. And the sponsors, they set up their like tables where you can play something or pinball or get massages, or like they try to do their best to like entertain our audience. Nice. So they also maybe tell a little bit about of themselves, because of course they want to recruit people and whatever, but for us, it's important that we can work in collaboration to create value to the conference.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think the conference itself, I prefer single track, so we run single track.
Absolutely.
I do themed sessions, so I have multiple sessions, a little bit like in Half Stack. So let's say I have a team like styling or design systems. Then I figure out good speakers for the session, and they figure out how to make the session really good, so they can avoid overlap in terms of presentation. And why we do this is that on the first year, I made tiny experiment. So I had 2 speakers about reason, And no sane person will put two talks about the same topic after each other. But I did that. So I put the theoretical reason talk first, and then I put the practical after that. And it happened to be a great idea, because now people got the, like, why reason is like that, what's the syntax, whatever. Like 30 minutes that and 30 minutes live coding. So because this worked so well, then I ran with the concept. So now this is what we more or less want to achieve, that people see the same topic from different angles and get more understanding of what the topic is about.
Yeah, the order of talks and making sure the speakers talk to each other when there's potential for overlap is really key to a good conference. So one of the early events I ran in 2010 or 11 was called the London Ajax Mobile event. And there was this technology that had just come out like the week before called Winery, which was Web Inspector Remote. And suddenly you could inspect a mobile application from your desktop Safari browser. And what happened is all eight speakers spent 5 minutes talking about Winery, and which led to a really bad experience because everyone heard the same thing over and over again. And so what I've gone to great lengths to do is put the talks in the right order. And if there is overlap, have those speakers talk to each other in advance so they're not basically giving the same talk. So clearly you're doing that as well, because you're like, this is the theoretical part, this is the practical part. Mm. And I assume you have them collaborate in advance.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's very important that the speakers collaborate, because I've been a conference speaker for a while. And normally how it works, I propose a topic, then they put me to speak about my topic. I don't do collaboration with other speakers, but from my perspective, it's wrong. So what I want, especially, is the collaboration.
Absolutely.
Because it's so important in terms of quality. If you want quality conference, you have to design the schedule well. You have to make sure speakers know what they're doing and how they're doing and they're coordinated.
Yeah. I like to say that the best conference is like a really good movie, in that you've got a flow to it. And yeah, there's ups and downs and highs and lows, but you end up on like just this feeling of, I accomplished a lot, or I really appreciated the story that was told. And so my company SitePen also organizes TSConf, which is the TypeScript conference in Seattle. And the hardest part is which speaker should follow Anders Heilsberg, because he's the creator of TypeScript and C# and all these other things. So you wouldn't put the person who's giving the most technical talk right after Anders, mm-hmm, because it's like the person can't compete with Anders, the creator of the language. So you put a lighter talk or a more fun talk or a talk that's about a very different thing after it, because otherwise it's like, well, that was a letdown. Instead, you have to give a very different talk to what Anders is going to do. And then similarly in Halfstack, you know, what we kind of do is we kind of end up with the talks that kind of transition to the after party. So the more crazy and wild talks tend to be at the end, because it like is a natural segue from more traditional talks to after party. Mm-hmm. So that's where we have our talks where someone's like live using speech recognition to like live detect their rap lyrics, or my Yoda Web Spock talk or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so there is definitely this sort of crescendo that happens at the end, just like a good movie ends on like this high.
So
note.
I actually ended this year's React Finland in two presentations that were not so much about React, but they were soft topics. I had two amazing women speakers, and they ended the conference like talking about architecture and how you approach refactoring, how do you like deal with empathy in development, because the point was that everyone was a beginner once and we should not forget this. So it was very soft message at the end of the conference, because that's maybe one of the things that people will remember from the conference. It's what they see at the last session of the whole thing.
Yeah. Was that Carolyn Stransky or someone else?
Yeah.
Carolyn's awesome. Hopefully she listens to this, because we had her at Halfstack last year and she gave this 10-minute, she proposed a talk about self-care, but I didn't quite see how it fit in with Halfstack. And so I thought about it for a day, because I knew she was a very good speaker and well-respected. And I'm like, Halfstack's a UI-centric conference. So what if you made it about the most important UI, the human UI, you?
Mm.
And she said, wow, I'd never thought of it that way, but that's perfect. And so she basically gave the same talk, but kind of inverted the emphasis.
Mm.
And it was one of the best received talks at Halfstack last year, because it was a vast collection of resources you could do to take care of yourself, but from the perspective of an engineer rather than the perspective of like a psychologist or a yoga expert or whatever. It was from here's how you take care of yourself, engineers, so you don't burn yourself out, which was really cool.
Yeah, I think it's very important to have these soft topics in technical conferences, because, I mean, you will think that you go there and you learn more about tech, but it's actually, as a conference organizer, you should provide a little bit more. So for me, it makes perfect sense to have these soft topics included.
Yeah, you really want a good conference to provide you a lot of different things than what you already know.
Yeah.
Because there's no point in going to a conference where, well, I already knew all of that. Right? So you need stuff that surprises you or that makes you think differently and just exposes you to different elements. And I usually say a good conference talk is one that is not a good blog post, because a good blog post means I can just read it at home. I don't have to experience it in person. So something where the in-person experience either makes it more entertaining or more engaging or more immersive, or just you wouldn't know to pay attention to this thing. And now that you're there, sitting there, you experience something amazing.
So one of the category of talks I try to find is what I call transformative talks. So a transformative talk for me is a talk that after the talk, your understanding about something changed. So like this year we had, it's a longer story. So I went to Web Expo last year. And I mean, I met this developer I met on Discord, I mean Reactive Flux Discord, and then I met him, and then I learned more about what he's doing and developing, and then I learned that he wrote a really cool solution for doing layout in React. The point of this approach is that because normally in web development, layout is something like that's more like an afterthought, or we leave it to CSS. But what he did, he elevated the topic to React library, so you could have React components for handling layout, which is kind of revolutionary. It's a revolutionary kind of concept for React developers that now you have to layout like this. And then, because he isn't the speaker or wasn't the speaker, so what I did first, because I was thinking this topic is something that might fit, so I got him to Vienna. So I paid him a trip to Vienna, so we did the first talk in React Vienna. And then I proposed that come to React Finland, let's do it again. So he took the already good talk and made it excellent. It was one of the best talks of the whole conference. So this first time speaker with a great topic and great preparation gave amazing talk.
Yeah, it's really easy to just pick superstars, but it's really amazing when you can find a few new speakers or first time speakers and help them tell their story and support them and watch them succeed. And what was interesting is last year at Halfstack, we had 4 first-time speakers, and no one in the audience could have told me who the first 4-time speakers were.
Impressive.
Yeah.
But I think it's, I mean, of course you need some superstars to get people interested, but you also need this, what I did this year, I actually asked, who should I bring to React Finland next time? And you know what happened? Everyone, they might not answer, and if the answer is Dan Abramov. So it's like they want only one person to my conference, and it's the one person I cannot get. So
right. Well, that's always a challenge, because the true superstars probably want to be writing code rather than speaking at conferences.
Yeah.
But you know, or they only want to. If you speak at too many conferences in a year, 1 year I spoke at like 50 conferences, which shouldn't be possible, but somehow it was.
Yeah.
And I got no engineering done the whole year. And I felt like a fraud by the end of the year, because I felt like I couldn't actually, had nothing interesting to say. So after that, I cut myself down, and my limit is around 8 to 10 now, because anything more than that, and I don't have any time to actually learn anything or do anything to share. And so unless I have a team of people just creating stuff for my conference talks, I have nothing of value to add if I speak that much. But then if there's 500 or 1,000 conferences trying to get the same 20 people, well, you can imagine how this devolves pretty rapidly. So it's a real challenge. So it's why we need to get new speakers and new people interested in participating.
So how many Halfstack conferences did you run before your process got efficient and you could sort of scale it up?
Oh, you assume it's efficient? I'm kidding. This is the 5th year of London. I felt like the first 2 years I was figuring out what the conference should become. And then the 3rd year and the 4th year, I felt like it was really smooth and I had a good process down and I had things done. Now, what's interesting is I'm collaborating with Juho. I've seen a lot of things that I could be doing better that he has automated, and I'm still not quite there on some of his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, we each have our strengths and weaknesses. I am pretty good at helping people understand the value of this conference and talking through that with them. And Juho's really good at like making it so if you have a good collection of data, you can generate like all the social media assets and graphic elements and stuff that you need to promote your event. And so there's a lot you can learn from collaborating with new people organizing conferences. And it's only gotten more efficient, but I've also been able to hand off some more of the work. So I have a design agency we work with, and they're taking on a more active role in creating things to promote the conferences, and they're managing the Instagram presence because I really don't understand what makes for a good Instagram account. So they're making that worthwhile. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, definitely getting help where I can, partnering with people in each city so they can help find a venue. Like Yuho did an amazing job finding this lovely Anchor Sala venue that I would have never found on my own. And really,
he knows
just
all the good places to eat around here, so he does.
Yes, he does. He's great at that. And so there's just a lot of challenges in running an event that you can't do yourself, especially if you're not local to the area. So I think we've got a pretty good process down, but it is, there's always ways to improve.
How are you doing for time? I know you got to run.
Pretty soon, yeah. I think, yeah.
We could probably definitely have you on the show again. All right. What's some of the one or two main things that you've done to automate the whole conference things there, Yuho?
I mean, it started from the content API. I think the realization that I need to control my content in one place, it really was the starting point for everything else. Because on top of that, you can do mobile app, you can do website, you can do graphic assets, you can do everything on top of a good content API. So just, if you have to do one thing for a conference, do a content API.
Otherwise, you end up fixing a typo or changing information in one spot, but not the other 10 places.
Yeah, exactly.
Where it's changed.
You need one source of truth, because if you have like multiple places to update, you never get it done.
Yep.
Okay. Well, this is your it's gonna be an interesting title. Something conference masterclass and a bunch of all this stuff, probably.
Well, I think the best JavaScript conferences are those organized by JavaScript developers, because otherwise, you don't know what makes for a good event.
That's it.
Yeah. So thank you so much for having us on the show. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Yuho and Dylan. And this is Nikos at Learn With Us. Thank you for listening, coming on and spending your time listening to us. And we'll see you again shortly. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.